Hello, everyone. I'm Crystal Bauer, founder of Live Greatly. I'm an entrepreneur in wellness and a keynote speaker with an extensive healthcare background, striving to push past the boundaries of fear to live life fully from a place of optimal health, joy, and success. Now for a quick disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are purely the opinions of the author. They are not intended to provide medical advice or treatment recommendations, and the contents of this podcast are intended for informational and educational purposes only. Always seek the guidance of your physician or other qualified healthcare professional when you have any questions regarding your specific health, any changes to diet and exercise, and any medical conditions. Now let's jump into the topic for today's podcast. And so today we are very lucky to have a really inspiring guest, Jason Pfeiffer. And Jason is the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. He's the host of three podcasts: Pessimist Archive, a history show about why people resist new things; Hush Money, about the way money makes life awkward; and Problem Solvers, about entrepreneurs solving unexpected problems in their business. He's been an editor at Men's Health, Fast Company, Maxim, and Boston Magazine, and he's written about business and technology for the Washington Post, Slate, New York, and others. His novel, Mr. Nice Guy, which he wrote with his wife, is currently being developed for television. And Jason lives in Brooklyn. So welcome, Jason. I'm so excited to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, I wanted to kind of talk to you about the concept of change. And I've heard you talk about this before. And I think right now in our world, there's just so many things going on. And change is all around us, you know? And I think the unknown is always so unsettling for people.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what your perspective is on this and how people can get more comfortable with the idea of change.
Yeah, I think that this is a really exciting moment. I mean, notwithstanding all the challenges and terrible things that are happening to people, right? I don't want to dismiss both the impact of the virus and of course also the we're now having a nationwide conversation about racial equality. But what we're seeing is a push, a very active push towards some kind of future. and I think that is getting into people's heads, this fact that the future is not optional. You cannot opt out of evolutions into your business, into your lives, that we have to constantly rethink what it is that we do and how we do it. And people don't like to do that. There is a comfort that we all seek to find something, know how to do it, know what it is, know that it works for us, and then stay there and expect that the world can adapt to us. And that's just not how it is. And I think that this is a really valuable wake-up call for people, because we are going to see tremendous things come out of this. I'd be happy to list them off, just the ones that I can predict or anticipate. But there's so many great things that are going to happen out of this, but it's going to happen because we have changed how we work, we've changed what we do, we've changed who we work with. And it was forced upon us, but it was going to happen anyway. The only difference is that it happened faster than we anticipated, and it forced us all to recognize that we have to keep up.
Yeah, that's really well said. I think for me personally, I'm shifting from doing lecturing and guest speaking in person. And now it's like, oh my gosh, I have to do everything online. Like, how do I do Zoom? How do I figure out how to launch a webinar? Like, and it's learning, and it's learning fast, you know? So it's been a lot of research and digging in. And there are those moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, I have that fear that creeps in. Like, can I do this? You know, the self-doubt. But I've learned how to look past that and try and switch it to like, okay, I'm learning a new skill. And,
you know what you're doing is you're recognizing, and I've gone through the same thing, especially with speaking. We often confuse the way with the value. All right, so we have a way of doing something, and we think that the way is the value. So let's just use public speaking, for example, which is not something that everybody does, but I think it's a nice kind of very simple and easy to visualize example. So public speaking, you and I, you know, I love being on stage, absolutely love it. I think I'm very good at it. So when I go on stage and I deliver a talk and people get something from it, I've come to think that the way that I do it, the way that I move on stage, that I am on stage, is the value. Mm-hmm. And now something has changed and we can't be on stage. And again, people can't do the other things that they were doing that was the way they were expressing the value. And so their first way of thinking is, oh no, I don't have value anymore. And what you have to recognize is that the way wasn't the value, right? When I get up and give a talk, the way that I speak and that I'm speaking on stage isn't the value. The value is what I'm saying and the message that I have. And that can be communicated in so many different other ways. You know, if you're a teacher, the way that you teach that you're in a classroom may not be the thing that is really core to the value that you have to offer. It's the information that you have and the respect you have for your students and the way that you understand how students think and learn and so on. That's the value. We confuse the way with the value, and that's very dangerous because it means that once there's some kind of roadblock, we say, oh, well, we're done. Well, I just don't have anything else anymore. And you have to look deeper. You have to understand what you really have to offer, because I guarantee you it's not the way that you did it. It is something deeper than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And confidence is huge for this. And I think having that like inner knowing of your value and your worth, regardless if things don't work out. And like as a new entrepreneur, like I came from a long healthcare background and now I'm like, all right, I'm figuring out business. So marketing and all the rest of it. And there's been times where like, oh, that didn't work out the way I was hoping it would. Right. And I'm learning that it's all about resilience and just that belief in yourself and adapting. And instead of looking at it as a failure, looking at it as a learning experience, you know, and next time I'll do this a little differently. But it takes definitely some practice, I think, to have that mentality and that mindset.
Yeah, it certainly does. It's not a natural way to think. You know, the natural way to think is in a very linear way. I do this, it leads to this, it leads to this, it leads to this. I can plan and predict it. And I know exactly how it's growing to grow. But that's not the way things are. That's not most people's paths. And once you accept that there is going to be constant change, that you're going to constantly adapt, it's actually pretty exciting because it means that you know, if you're on a linear path, then the only thing that happens after A is B, right? There's only one thing to do. But if you're on a nonlinear path, well, then A leads to HJ75 question mark, right? Yeah. Like it can lead to anything. And that means that you can be so much more experimental at every stage of your journey. You can be so much more open to new opportunities, to new discoveries. I run this at a magazine, Entrepreneur Magazine. I mean, 10 years ago, I was at Men's Health. And a few years before that, I was a community newspaper reporter. I could not have predicted this path. Yeah. This path makes absolutely no sense. But the thing is that I early on in my career, I stopped thinking about a linear path. And I realized that I needed to start thinking about something that was deeper. The way that I thought about it was skill sets, that every job that I took wasn't about the job itself. It was about the skills that it taught me. So when I went to Men's Health, the reason that I went to Men's Health was to learn a particular kind of magazine editing that's called packaging. And then the next job that I took was Fast Company, which, you know, it doesn't seem to make any sense going from a men's magazine to a business magazine. But I did it not because of business, honestly. I did it because they were going to give me an opportunity to learn something else, which was long form editing. And then while I was there, there was a video department that started and nobody asked me to join the video department, but I just got involved anyway, because I knew that if I got in front of a camera and learned how to do it well, that it would lead to all sorts of great opportunities. And that is how I am talking to you right now, functionally speaking, because that's how I learned how to talk on a microphone and talk in this kind of energetic voice that I have, which is not like, you know, when I'm like at dinner, I'm not talking like this, but this is what works on a microphone. And I learned that. Could you imagine? Nobody would want to have dinner with me. This is what works on a microphone. And this is what I learned by standing in front of a camera at Fast Company, which is a job that I took to learn how to do long form magazine editing. And all of these things, by just focusing on skill sets, it opened up all sorts of other doors. So I would not be where I am now and doing the kinds of things that I'm doing now if it wasn't for constantly thinking, what can I learn, even though I don't know the ROI on it and I don't know where it's going to land me? All I know is that it's going to open more doors, and that's worth doing.
Yeah. You have such a sense of curiosity. And I think that served you really well. And it served me really well in my my life and my path as well. And I think there was a period of time in my life where I kind of put myself and my capabilities into a box. Like, mm-hmm. I can do this, I can't do this. In order to do this, I have to check this off and do this and do that. And when I stopped thinking like that, like, whoa, what? No, that's not true. You know, I made that mm-hmm. up, picked it up from somewhere.
Yeah.
Really amazing things can happen. And I think when you have it happen once, then it's like, oh, it's eye-opening. Like, wow, I didn't have to do all that stuff to have this achievement or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you're constantly teaching yourself mm-hmm. about your own potential.
Yeah. And,
you know, it's a funny thing. People, even accomplished people, tend to doubt that they controlled their own fate. And, you know, let's be fair. There's a little luck in everything. I took a lot of risks in my career and was very fortunate that they worked out. But at the same time, I came to appreciate that I am doing something right too, that I know how to walk into a completely new environment mm-hmm. and get a quick sense of what it is that people are looking for and then figure out how to deliver on that. But that's a scary thing for people because people tend to have some kind of success and then they think that they can't replicate it. Mm-hmm. They're afraid to start over because they won't be able to rebuild what they did because whatever they did was the product of too much luck or the right people helping them at the right time or one great idea that they'll never. And so what do they end up doing? Well, they become more conservative. And I don't mean that in a political sense. I just mean that in a, you know, less risk-taking, mm-hmm. more retrenching to base kind of thinking. And so they stop taking risks and they stop innovating and they stop trying to grow. And then as careers go on, this is how people stall out. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to take some risks in the beginning because it felt like, well, doesn't matter. I'm young. I have nothing to lose. I'll take this risk. It worked out. And now I lucked into this plot of land and I got to hold it with everything that I've got. And I got to tell you something. You can't hold the land. If you sit there, it just shrinks. It just shrinks on you. You know, there's a really interesting theory about why, this feels like it's slightly all over the place, but it all ties together. There's a really interesting theory about why big companies get disrupted. So, you know, you think about, for example, Blockbuster. No, mm-hmm. Did Blockbuster not see streaming coming? Did they not see Netflix coming? No, they saw it. They're not idiots. They saw it. But the problem is that big companies, and I think that individuals do this as well. This is the explanation for my transition into this anecdote. The reason that they get disrupted is because they stop taking risks mm-hmm. and they start trying to just make the thing that they do as efficient as possible, right? They stop thinking big and they start thinking small and they start to think, I know how to do this one thing. Let's just make sure that we can do this thing as good as possible. All the people that we're going to hire and we're going to train them and we're only going to train them to do the thing that we already do. Mm-hmm. And so then when change comes along, you literally don't have the mechanism inside of you, individually or as a company, to adapt because the entire structure of your organization is designed just to do the thing that you do.
Right.
And that means that you are dead. And so instead, what's a different way of thinking of it? A different way of thinking of it is that you devote a portion of your structure to constant evolution. And you make sure that everybody at every level of your organization understands that change is necessary and it's going to come. And sometimes it's going to come slow and sometimes it's going to come fast. And you stay on the front part of your feet the entire time. This is the only way to survive long-term.
Yeah. Yeah. And getting comfortable with being uncomfortable and just recognizing that that's where the growth happens and not just, again, like being stuck in that box, you know. I'm curious with your experience and all the different people that you've interviewed. I'm sure you've had some incredible interviews with your time at Entrepreneur and the other magazines. I'm really fascinated by the idea of achieving success and really, you know, having your goals met in a way that actually is nourishing for your body and your mind. Because I think a lot of times it's like a badge of honor when you kind of sacrifice yourself or you sacrifice your health and you sacrifice your sleep, you know, your mental health to achieve your goal. And I really am like, well, there has to be a way to do it both. My background's in mental health. So a lot of it is optimizing your mental health while you're working to, you know, have your vision come to fruition. So I'm curious if you've seen that in anyone that you've interviewed or in yourself, like, what do you think, what qualities do you think are necessary to be able to actually have health and success?
Well, I think it goes back to the word that you just said there, goal, because people define goal and they define success in very different ways. Mm-hmm. And there's a healthy way to define it and a not healthy way to define it. And, you know, to me, the healthiest way to think about a goal or success is to think about it as a very long-term thing, right? If you define it narrowly and short-term, or you define it by some particular metric, then you are going to look at almost everything that you do as a very life or death kind of decision, right? It either gets you to the goal or it doesn't. You have to reach this particular number or you're a failure. And the people that I see that are successful are people who have defined their goal in some way abstractly and with a long-term vision, a long understanding of the thing that they're doing and the reason that they're doing it. I'll give you one little example. This is one of my favorite stories. So there's this guy, his name is Sam. He started a brewery called Dogfish in Delaware.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, any beer fans will know Dogfish. And Sam's a beer lover. And his goal with this company was to create a really innovative, fun, boundary pushing beer company. And early on, he created a beer. It was called 90 Minute IPA, very strong IPA. 90 Minute meant 9% alcohol by volume. And you know, that's a strong beer. That's mm-hmm. that's like a put you on the floor kind of beer. And people told him, this is a great beer, but wouldn't it be great if you could drink this standing up? Like, can you lower the alcohol volume? And so he made a 6% beer that he called 60 Minute IPA. And this thing took off like mad. It was a huge, huge hit. It was the kind of thing that most entrepreneurs dream of having. You put something out in the market and people just love it and they want it and they desire it and they're ordering it like crazy. And so the Dogfish is suddenly fielding orders from around the country, bars, restaurants, you know, alcohol stores, whatever, Amtrak. And very, very quickly, 60 Minute IPA becomes on track to become about 80% of all sales of Dogfish. Just to say that 80% of everything that this company was selling was going to be this one beer. Now, if you had a short-term understanding of what your goal and what success looked like, then this might give you some excitement and also some panic, because you will say, oh my gosh, I have a hit product. This is the moment. This is the moment that I've been waiting for. It all comes down to this. Everything rides on this. I'm going to sell the hell out of this beer. And you might do that very thing. You might sell and sell and sell. You might make a bunch of money. But what comes next, if you're thinking that way? What comes next? Where is your goal and where is your vision in that? So let me tell you what Sam did. He did something that feels very, very counterintuitive. He thought, well, I've got this hit product. I love this beer. Everyone loves this beer. It's great. Here's the problem. The problem is that it's an IPA, which is to say it's a single style of beer and tastes will change. So although right at that moment, IPAs were a very popular style of beer, they aren't going to be the dominant style of beer forever. His consumers will want something different at some point. And if he gives into this, if he allows this beer to be the sole way that people experience his company, if every time they walk into a store or walk into a bar, the one Dogfish beer that they see is the 60 Minute IPA, then the minute the tastes change, he becomes old and outdated. And so Sam limited sales of his best-selling beer. He capped it at 50%. It could have been 80% of all sales. He capped it at 50%. That meant that people were very angry at him. They were calling, they were yelling, they were screaming. They were screaming at him on the streets in Delaware. And I've walked around Delaware with Sam. People love him. He's a celebrity there. They were screaming. But, and this is the reason I bring this story up, because I asked Sam, you know, you had asked me about mental health and feeling, you know, feeling like you were on the right path. I asked him if he was ever concerned about this decision that he had made. And he said no. Like, he had people screaming at him. Mm-hmm. His company, which had the potential to be just riding a runaway hit, was instead the subject of people's ire. But he was not nervous and he was not concerned. He was calm. And you know why? It was because Sam understood what his goal was. He understood what his vision of success was. And it wasn't to have a one-hit product, and it wasn't to make a ton of money all at once. It was to have a sustainable long-term business that was based on this thing that he had, this vision that he had of being an innovative beer company. So when people called and they asked him for this beer, he said, "I'm sorry, we don't have it right now. We make it very fresh and it's just not available. I would love you to try another style of beer. Let me tell you about our Saison or whatever the hell." And that is how Sam avoided being known as a one-hit wonder IPA brand, mm-hmm. and instead became known as an innovative, long-term, long-sustaining, beloved brand that last year sold for $300 million.
Wow. That's a great story. You know, I think that we really need to define our why, you know, and get grounded and like come back to that. And like, going to be different for everybody, but it's really tuning into yourself and making sure that your message and what you're doing resonates with your why and what's important to you. And I know that we're running out of time, so I'm curious, anything else you want to add, and how can people find you? You're doing so many cool things.
Yeah.
And I'll put a link to some of your stuff on the episode description, but just wondering if you have any last things you'd like to say. And again, how can people get a hold of your stuff?
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm doing a ton of stuff. If there's one thing based on this conversation that we've had about the importance of change, I would like to direct you to one of the podcasts that I do, which is called Pessimist's Archive. So Pessimist Archive's goal is to understand why people are afraid of change and then how change actually happens. And we do that by looking back in time at the way that people resisted the things that today we think of as so commonplace that we cannot imagine that they were ever scary. So cars, bicycles, chess, coffee, teddy bears. I'll just sort of leave you with this final little anecdote. We just did an episode about the good that comes from a pandemic, which sounds weird, but I started that because I was curious about what happened after the Black Plague of the 1300s, the bubonic mm-hmm. plague. And so I called up a medieval historian, and he told me, it's a long and fascinating tale, but one quick element of it is that, think about this. So 1300s, Europe, it's a serf and lord system, which is basically a slavery system. And, the serfs are owned by the lord. They are the workers. They are not compensated. They are not treated as humans. And that was the way things were. And then the bubonic plague came along, and it wiped out upwards of 60% of Europe. And when things reached some level of normalcy and people tried to get back to work, the lords looked at their land and realized that they no longer had the serfs needed to do the work. And there were some remaining serfs. And those serfs discovered that they had power, because suddenly they were in demand. The lords needed them. Right? Because the lords needed people to work the land, and there weren't a lot of serfs left. And so the lords needed the serfs. The lords needed to pay the serfs. The lords needed to enter into something that, you know, resembles in some early way a employment contract with the serfs. And some serfs said, you know what? I am done with this. I'm not working for these lords at all, regardless. And they went to the cities and they formed the very first merchant class. They started selling textiles and spices. And that is the origin of the economy as we know it. The reason that we have employment contracts and an understanding that labor has value it goes back to that.
Wow.
And the reason that I want you to think about that is because moments of disruption create new opportunities, new ways to think, new normals. Yeah. And also, moments of disruption can destroy an incumbent and create the opening for somebody underneath them to rise up instead. And that is, when you think about it, what's happening now in a way. I mean, it's obviously not that transformative, and we are not going to lose 60% of people, thankfully. But what we're in right now is a moment in which we are going to have to rethink who does what and what the opportunities are and what problems are to be solved and what relationships do we have with each other. And that is hard and it can be messy, but it can also be tremendously productive. And if you were to look at it as an optimist, you would say, well, if you are willing to embrace the change and see that everything that's happening now isn't some kind of ending, it's actually just a shifting of where the roads go, well, then be nimble and think about what it is that your goal is and what's down at your core and what drives you and how can you be a part of the solution going forward. And that will bring you tremendous, tremendous opportunity. So anyway, that's something that came out of Pessimist Archive, and you know, people are free to go check out a whole bunch of other stuff like it.
That's fantastic. Okay, well, I will, I'll put a link in my episode description so people can find it easily. And this was just such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you being on the show today.
You bet. Thanks so much.
Thank you everyone for tuning in today. You can follow Live Greatly on Instagram and Twitter at livegreatly_CO and on Facebook at livegreatly.co. And you can learn more about me and Live Greatly on my website, www.livegreatly.co. I'm available for speaking opportunities on multiple wellness topics, optimizing mental health and performance. So please reach out if I can help you or your business. And if you like what you heard today, I would greatly appreciate you leaving a review and subscribing to the podcast. Until next time, this is Crystal Bauer with Live Greatly, encouraging you all to awaken your ultimate potential.